Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. I'm joined in conversation by Daniel McQueen, author of the just released book, Psychedelic Cannabis, which is all about using cannabis to help heal and treat trauma. And as it just so happens, he's the third Daniel interview in a row, so it's our Daniel trifecta here on the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. You can find out more about Daniel and his work in Boulder, Colorado at his webpage, medicinalmindfulness.org. We'll get to the conversation in just a moment, but first, as always, a few quick announcements before we do so. We'd like to say thank you to Axel, who has signed up as a new patron over at my Patreon page. If you would like to lend your support to the work that I do and this podcast, you can always come on over to patreon.com/martinwball. I have everything from $1 a month up to $100 a month with increasing access, benefits, and gifts all along the way. And you can choose whatever level is most comfortable for you. And of course, if you are in the mood, you are welcome to make a PayPal donation to the podcast. Just stop by my personal webpage at martinball.net. and use the PayPal link that is at the top right of the page. And it's by donations from listeners like you that help keep this podcast going and making this content available out there in listener land. Also, I do like to remind you that I am available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations to help you integrate your entheogenic experience, particularly from a non-dual and energetic perspective. You can always check out my webpage for that, non-dual entheogenicintegration.com, if you want to find out more details. And no matter where you are in the world, I have clients really from all different time zones and all over the planet every week. We can find a time that we can talk and kind of get down into the nitty-gritty of your experience, what's going on, and where we might be able to help. Also, would like to let you, the listening audience, know that I have a new album of ambient music available, which is at my Bandcamp page, martinball.bandcamp.com. It's called In Twilight Times. As I've mentioned here in the podcast, I had been working on the audiobook for my latest medical memoir, A Sleep Story, which is all about my chronic sleep disorder and current medical condition. And I had created a few really simple ambient tracks to go with the audiobook. And once I wrapped all that up, I decided that I would expand on some of those tracks and kind of flesh them out a little bit. And now it's a nice collection of 37 minutes of music of six tracks. It kind of goes through lots of different energies and lots of different spaces. Some of it's very inviting. Some of it's kind of edgy and uncomfortable because that's my current reality and it's a reflection of that. So again, that's over at my Bandcamp page. That's martinball.bandcamp.com. And it's called In Twilight Times. One thing that I will mention about my conversation here with Daniel McQueen is that we were interrupted by leaf blowers about halfway through our conversation. So I've done what I can to reduce that background noise that was introduced while we were conversing. But you will notice here and there are leaf blowers, and I apologize for that, but that's kind of the reality of having an office in an urban environment, which really is not an office. This is just sort of my office living room space, and there's lots of windows and there's lots of leaf blowers. It's just part of the territory. But anyway, let's go ahead and get into our conversation with Daniel. Again, it's Daniel McQueen, author of Psychedelic Cannabis, and we're going to be talking all about somatic body releases, how trauma is stored in the body, how trauma is released in the body, and what are some of the best methods and techniques and practices, and really all the work that Daniel does around this in his center in Boulder, Colorado. So lots of great information. I'm sure you'll enjoy the conversation. As is usual these days, it's another long one. So sit back, relax, kick up your feet, and take a toke if you like. Here's Danny McQueen, author of Psychedelic Cannabis. Yeah, I'd like to just start by inviting you to share with me, with the audience, how you got into this work. I mean, you've mentioned in your book many times about your own healing journey and kind of cultivating this in yourself and then branching out and looking to inspire the world. So let's start there. What was what's your background and your own healing story, and how did cannabis contribute to that?
Yeah, gosh, it's always such a big question, isn't it? You know, so, well, I've been as into working with psychedelics since before I was, or since I was a young adult. It's always been something that's deeply inspired me. And I was fortunate to be part of intentional communities when I was younger. They were on the spiritual side of the spectrum of the psychedelic work. And at some point I realized that there was some pieces missing. And that's when I went back to school and got my master's at Naropa for psychotherapy and counseling from a transpersonal perspective. And I got involved with MAP studies and got involved in the movement. That's when, that's when it really started taking off. This was about 12 years ago or so. A couple of years after that, in 2014, cannabis became legal in Colorado. And a friend of mine said, "Hey, I know about your interest in psychedelic therapy. Have you ever considered working with cannabis as a psychedelic?" And to be honest, I just never had. Like, I had had really profound experiences with cannabis before. More often, it was in conjunction with another psychedelic or something, but I had had, specifically cannabis experiences. And we gave it a try with some friends, and it just really blew us all away. We were surprised by the intensity of the experience and the depth of it. And I've just been on this road ever since. It's just been ongoingly more and more inspiring, So I come from a history of childhood bullying. I grew up in Arkansas, and I'm just as I am now as I was as a kid. It's very different, especially in that area. I was told I had an overactive imagination and our felt too was too sensitive about things in life, basically meant I had like a heart, so I think I had, some pretty significant trauma growing up and didn't realize it until much later. And psychedelics for sure helped me through that process, but cannabis has been the part that's gotten it into my body, like gotten the healing physically in my body, and it's helped me the most really through that process. And so now I get to share it with all kinds of people. We have a training program where I teach people how to do this, and we have a center here where we get to share these practices and sessions with others. And it's just ongoingly meaningful, So that's kind of how I got involved.
Okay.
Just followed a thread.
Yeah.
I mean, the typical psychedelic exploration. It's like, what's under this little rock here? And just takes you on a ride.
Well, there's a few things that you just mentioned there that I'd like you to maybe expand on a little bit and follow up on. And first, just going back to the idea that you had been living in intentional spiritual communities and that you felt that there was something lacking there. I have my own opinions and views there about spirituality and spiritual communities, and I'm just kind of curious what it was that you felt was maybe not being addressed.
So I wasn't living in these communities. These were just communities that I was part of, and friends of friends. These were never psychotherapeutic communities. These were more on the spiritual community side. And I think there was some overuse. I think there was some lack of education of the effects of psychedelics. I mean, this was a long time ago. This was 20 years ago. Like, I didn't know what Arrowwood was at that time. And, this just wasn't part of the conversation. And some of the misconceptions, like, you can pray your struggles away, were common there. It's a little magical thinking there. Little bit of getting lost in the light, like overusing, not integrating. I mean, these words just weren't in the vocabulary at that time. And there was a sense of escaping something, like going to another world or another reality or another realm, and it was out of the body, And so I went to school, and I went to school to get the therapeutic, the psychological side of the work. Again, I was just not with people who were psychotherapists and such. And that showed me that there were specific techniques that could be used within these spaces instead of just surrendering into the experience or turning towards the light of the divine or whatnot that were really useful, you know. So I started to explore that. And then the somatic piece, like, I think, and cannabis has taught me this more and more, you know, like, that healing happens in the body, you know, and that cannabis helps bring us back into our bodies. So there's something really important about that process. You know, and I think there's just like some safety stuff. Like, I think it's not uncommon in our communities to hear things like, just keep taking more. If you're still struggling, keep taking more medicine, right? Like, or do that journey again. And, you know, for somebody who's really struggling, that can just be more and more destabilizing, right? So, so I just learned, I just realized I wanted to learn more perspectives, you know. And that's when I found Stan Grof's work, and that was really instrumental in getting me to Naropa. You know, it helped me understand my experiences from more of a therapeutic perspective than just a spiritual perspective, and it just made more sense to me, you know, to bring in the psychology aspect, you know. So, and there just wasn't that container in the communities that I was a part of. It just wasn't part of the language.
Yeah. And I think that that's a really important thing to recognize, because now, you know, perhaps in looking back on your life and say, well, I can see that these things were missing from the community. And, the reality is that this was not really part of the dialogue back then. It wasn't really part of the conversation. That now, I mean, these words that show up in your book, throughout, the idea of harm reduction, that's a relatively new concept. Mm-hmm. It's a new part of the discussion. And the emphasis on preparation and facilitation and integration, that these are all things that are being developed kind of right now. We're at the very forefront of that. And so mm-hmm. I think it's worthwhile to look back at maybe what was happening in the past, and we could be a little bit critical of that and say, well, these elements are missing, and also recognize that, well, no one was really thinking about that mm-hmm. at that time as well. And I do think that there has been a propensity towards, you know, certain forms of spiritual bypassing in the psychedelic yeah. community and spiritual communities. And sometimes we can, again, we can be critical of that, but also recognize, well, but that's, it wasn't even part of the consciousness then, that it was the idea of, well, let's just pray more, or let's have another ceremony. And I really mm-hmm. like your emphasis of what goes on in the body and how significant that is. And, you know, this is an area, you know, the medicine that I've most talked about is 5-MeO-DMT. And many people associate that with like completely out of the body,
sure.
complete transcendent experience. And I've always tried to bring the focus back to, well, what is actually happening in the body when people are in these states mm-hmm. and what is the potential for healing when we're actually addressing the body and not just a spiritual experience or some kind of mm-hmm. transcendent experience. So something else I wanted to ask you about, and then I want to come back to this in the body idea is,
sure.
Just that you mentioned being bullied in school, and that's certainly something that I encountered a whole lot of as a young person in school. So I can really identify with that. And I mean, I just get the feeling just seeing you here now and talking to you that you seem like a nice, gentle person and sensitive in those ways. But anyway, back to the concept of bullying and what takes place there. And it seems to be, at least for myself, as being a sensitive person, being someone who is different from others, that really just was a target for bullies and for people who wanted to be mean and wanted to mm-hmm. single me out. And that's even part of what then inspired my interest in cannabis, was that, well, these are all the people who want to drink alcohol. But even, you know, before that, going back into, you know, when I was a much smaller kid, before any substances were involved, and that helped form my identity as like, oh, well, I'm into something different, that I'm not interested in numbing myself, but I'm interested in opening up the imagination and the aesthetic experience that for me was made accessible through cannabis, you know, like listening to music or making art. And kind of,
yeah, it's not just getting drunk, right? Smoking yeah. cannabis is just not the same experience.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just curious how that played into your own maybe reaction to being bullied or how that helped inform your identity as someone who was interested in cannabis and in, mm-hmm. interested in sort of a different path, a different way of being mm-hmm. as a masculine being that is not just into alcohol or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, gosh, you're really dropping it back in the day. I was just always very different. I was always kind of an outsider, outcast. I was a little smaller. Maybe something about my way of being or mannerisms just like kind of stood me out as somebody that was different and could therefore be picked on or something. I don't actually fully understand how I was targeted and such, but it was a pretty consistent experience. You know, it was a pretty ongoing process for me growing up, you know, being bullied on the playground and such on a pretty regular basis. So I retreated into my internal world. I retreated into my art. I retreated into my imagination and creativity and ideas. And I also had a really big heart, you know, and I would get into fights trying to stop other people getting bullied, you know? So yeah. I always had this space of like activism in my life, you know, and growing up in Arkansas, being very conscious of like the race issues there, but not maybe having the words for it, you know? So I would connect with people and of different communities and was, you know, I was a community activist in that way for a long time. But I think like maybe as I got into my young adulthood, I smoked pot for the first time I was like 18. So I was a little on the older side and there was just something like it just dropped my nervous system down to a manageable level. And maybe I'd never experienced that before. There was just this immediate recognition that this was something that was special, even though the quality of the weed wasn't very good. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, like it just really was just a different plant, you know, 30 years ago or whatever. So, I think in my mid 20s or so, I started to realize that I wanted to make psychedelics part of my path, you know, and at this point I identify it as a core aspect of my identity. You know, I'm a medicine practitioner, identify as a medicine person, almost like a religious, you know, or spiritual, like core religious identity. And I think that part, you know, like, you know, maybe is a representation of how maybe I was kind of singled out, you know, like I was a critical thinker. I would question authority and things like that. So, you know, over time, I started to understand that, like, I was into things that were very different than other people. So, like, my daily life here now is I'm an advocate for a substance that used to be very illegal. It's somewhat legal now. That has so many misunderstandings and so much charge around it that, you know, to this day, I still get bullied for my advocacy in this work, because I'm advocating for something that represents, all the bad things in society, you know, like the gateway drug, right? That sort of thing. And it's taken me a while to like understand that, own it, and then have some space to explore that question with people, you know? So it's definitely been an interesting ride.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's return to the topic of in the body and your own healing work for yourself. Maybe if you could tell us a little bit about that and how your work with cannabis brought you into the body and mm-hmm. what healing potential you found there just for yourself, mm-hmm. let alone mm-hmm. how you're working with others and you know, mm-hmm. running the training programs, but really, again, mm-hmm. your own personal experience and how that worked for you.
Gosh. Yeah. You know, like, you know, I know you have the relationship with the 5-MeO. You know, I would say the first, so I'd worked with that medicine. That was a medicine that was part of the communities that I was a part of when I was younger. And that was like, that's like everybody, you know, goes out of the body out into, you know, into this other realm or the, all that is, right? The oneness of being. And one day, this was before I went to Naropa, so maybe 12, 13, 14 years ago or something. I did a solo journey with that medicine. And instead of going outward, I decided to turn it inward. you know, like just go right, use that awareness and that experience to just go inward. And my proprioceptive awareness was like obviously very lit up. And that was my first true, really healing experience I had with that medicine. Like they were always healing, but there was something very different about this one. And I actually had a rebirthing experience. You know what Stan Grof talks about, right? The significance of the birth process, and realize, and I had known enough about my my family history, my own birth process, that it wasn't an easy birth. My mom was induced, and you know it took a long time and all of that. So I had a very clear realization that I was being, you know, like of being crushed and squished in the, you know, in the birth canal, and how painful that was. And so I think I came into the world with some trauma, you know, and some big T trauma. And, but it was such a big experience that, you know, those are so hard to integrate. But fast forward, you know, like many years later, working with cannabis and in my own practice and learning what I learned about psychotherapy and somatic healing and such, I started to study alchemy as well. And there's this concept in alchemy called dross, which is like the crusty stuff around that comes out when you're purifying the metals and clearing things. And it's this idea of just this heavy, chunky material substance in that's like embedded in our bodies. It's embedded in our muscle tissue and our tensions and pains. It's embedded in our fascia. It's even embedded in our thoughts and our memories and such. It's anything that's unprocessed or causes, you know, causes stiffness or stuckness, you know, both emotionally or physically. And I started to learn in my own process that I could use cannabis to amplify my proprioceptive awareness, my felt sense awareness, right? And it amplified my ability to stay with the process. And the cannabis itself has muscle relaxing qualities to it, right? Like it's a natural muscle relaxant. And it was enough to start to engage this dross, just as if we were, you know, you're engaged in like a somatic experiencing, you know, like a other psychotherapeutic process. And I would, you know, and I would literally shake it out, you know, similar to maybe MDMA assisted psychotherapy, where people will tremble or shake it out. You know, those are really significant healing experiences. They just create so much more space in the body and such. And so I just kept doing that. I made it a personal practice, and I would, you know, about once a week, I would go into a meditation space and listen to some good music and smoke some cannabis and meditate and sit and meditate. I'd do a lot of stretching. And at some point I'd lie down with some good music playing, and my body would vibrate or tremble and shake it out. And in that process, I would have memories, I'd have emotional releases, all kinds of things. And it was such a meaningful experience to me that I wanted to share it with my friends. And, you know, so we started to do circles and such, and everybody was having these experiences. And I was just, you know, curious to figure out how to make it even more effective, you know? So I just started to experiment on all my friends, and bring it to them, introduce it to them. And I learned a lot from observing and participating in those experiences with them.
Yeah, but I really love the focus of what's going on in the body and the way that energy is encountered, whether they be emotions, thought patterns, behavioral patterns. And this is something that I've always promoted as a fundamental idea, that it's one thing to change your mind, to change your thought patterns, to change your behaviors, but that, to use your word, the dross, the residue of all
it's
of
like
our
a residue, yeah,
yeah, that it's actually mm-hmm. all stored in the body, even things that people mm-hmm. might conceive of as being spiritual wounds or spiritual issues, that it's not in some ephemeral place out mm-hmm. there, but it's actually all lodged within the body.
It's all lodged in the body. It's,
yeah.
It's in our fascia. It's in our muscles. It's in that spot that you stuff all your emotions in. It's where you've been hurt physically in the past, like from a car accident or whatever, you know, like it's just these kinks in our system. And then if you want to go into spiritual spaces, then that's in the body too. Like it's, there's a correlate, there's like a, we have a physical body and then we have an energetic body. We have a light body made up of whatever you want to call it. You know, there's different models for it. There's chakras and meridians and auras and things like that. That's part of our essence of being as well. And so there can be stuckness in our energetic field, a kink in a meridian that blocks the flow of, you know, essential energy through certain areas. And that can cause emotional blocks, all kinds of issues. And cannabis or something about it, it just opens up the body enough, just opens up the cellular structure enough to address it, you know, to resolve it in some way. It's not just in the nervous system, right? Like MDMA is really great for resolution of trauma, like held within the nervous system and the neural structure of the brain and such. But cannabis gets it like in your physical cells. And that's just, we call it a somatic psychedelic for that reason. You know, it's just like your whole body gets to trip, you know?
Yeah. And it's this very physical process where, as you're describing, there's tremors, there's vibrations, there's shaking, and that might be accompanied by making sounds. It might be accompanied by spontaneous free movements that take place in the body. And that when all of this is like, for someone who doesn't know about any of this, if it starts happening to them, it can seem very unusual and very strange. Like, why?
Super scary.
Yeah. Why is this happening? What's happening to my body? And it can trigger anxiety reactions and shutting down. But as you describe in your book, the more someone opens up to it and just allows and trusts that even though the process itself can be confusing and even unnerving while it's taking place, it actually does bring you to a place of resolution where you then feel complete, you feel better, that you feel that, wow, I have released this. And I think, you know, a lot of people think about like the purging that happens with ayahuasca or peyote, and they think in those kinds of terms, but don't always think in terms of these somatic experiences within the body that might include purging. Like you say in your book, have a bucket with a liner ready, because you never know when there might be some actual physical purging, but that these other forms of purging take place within the body as well, that is not necessarily as graphic as actually throwing up or having diarrhea, but it's still part of the same process. And I really love that you emphasize that word as well, that it's a process that takes time and you have to be available to it in order for it to take place.
Yeah. It's not like it's just like a switch or something, right? It's like a unfolding process. I normalize it, you know, like if you're not in the right container, if you're hanging out with friends or you're at a festival and all of a sudden this stuff is happening, it can be a really scary and unnerving experience. But in the right container with the right support, I remind people, and I tell myself all the time, it's like, this is what healing looks like. You know, this is good news. Like you know, shaking like that or twitching or having like spasms that are painful and releasing them, you know, you're right. It's just, you feel like there's a resolution and, you know, it doesn't mean like whatever happened didn't happen or whatnot, but there's a greater understanding and clarity and self-acceptance and compassion. It's just something is completed in these processes. And you know, and it's, you know, purging can happen on cannabis for sure, you know, but it's not that common, you know, and so it's a little gentler than say ayahuasca or peyote for these practices, you know, so it's just a little easier to stay with big experiences in a way, you know. One of the most fascinating experiences I had a physical healing I witnessed was with a client who came. She was pretty, she woke up with a really severe pain in her neck, and this was a common experience for her. But it was very clearly emotionally related to, and we were wondering if we should do the session or not, but she said she really wanted to. So I was guiding her through the process, and this was after she smoked, and just helping her bring awareness to her neck and the pain. And she was stretching very gently, and I was guiding her, and all of a sudden her whole neck just jerked, like almost violently. And there was a loud crack, like it came right out of that spot in her neck. And ever since then, it was like, you know, the energetically, there's just like this white flash that came out of it, right? It was extreme. And I thought she might have hurt herself. But ever since then, she hasn't had that pain in her neck. You know, there was something about that movement, that specific, like, self-authentic, spontaneous adjustment that occurred. It's like her body knew exactly what to do to resolve that tension there. And that was a really meaningful experience to see something transform like that. And that it would be permanent even, you know, or, you know, like whatever is permanent, but, you know, it's like, hasn't come back since, and this has been years, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of things to pick up on here. Maybe we could talk a little bit about what is the safe container and the safe setting, and again, kind of contrasting to this. So let's say you're at a concert and you take a couple hits off a joint and then you start shaking and vibrating and you like freak out, and like that could lead to an anxiety attack. And then, you know, maybe somebody going to the ER and, oh, I'm freaking out. But when you're in the right place and in the right time with the right support, that can then trigger the healing event. So in developing your own practice, share with us the details of what is it that makes for the right set and setting, the right intentions, and the right support to allow people to go through, again, what can be a very unusual and unnerving process. If you've never experienced these kind of somatic releases before, it can, the ego can react with it, like, what is happening to me? So how do you provide the safe container for that to take place and encourage people to go deeper into it, to really allow that process to take place and potentially complete with a resolution that is lasting?
We always do a prep session and an integration session around these journeys. So there's just a lot of education, you know, like, and this is what it's going to look like, and this is how it's going to feel, and, you know, and you might shake and tremble, and this is what that means, you know, so just a lot of education and support. And then the sessions themselves are set up like any psychedelic therapy session, you know, psilocybin or MDMA. We use beds. We don't put people on couches because I think people have to sometimes spread out from both directions, right?
Yeah.
So we have, you know, we use couches that turn into beds in our center. We have wonderful music playing. We have altars in our rooms. The medicine's taken with intention, you know, either through a guided meditation or even a prayer. And then there's just an opportunity, like, especially with cannabis. Sometimes people say, I get paranoid or panicky on cannabis. I remind them that this is different than a social setting, and they don't have to talk. They don't have to, you know, perform in any way, that this is their experience. And I just invite them to lie down, you know, which is, again, something you can't do normally at a party or at a concert or whatnot. And so when they lie down, I will guide them through a body scan meditation. And that's like helps calm your nerves as the booster rockets are taken off and you're flying through the atmosphere, you know, like things are really taken off at that point. So in a way, a body scan is a, you know, it's a good mindfulness practice to help relax the body, but it's a nice distraction in a way to support that transition and make it a little easier. And then in the space itself, somebody's trembling, I'll remind them that this is what healing looks like, normalize it, and coach them on relaxing all around it and breathing with it, and just letting arise whatever is arising, to notice what's there. And some people are real quiet, and it's more like a DMT trip or something like that. They're just internal and there's not much communication. Other people are super communicating, like an MDMA journey or something. And when I get to be in a space with somebody who's talking, I reflect back and offer guidance and support and just help them stay with the experience. And then in our practice, I teach these guide skills, like meditation skills, to keep the client or keep the guide regulated, they keep the guide regulated and their nervous system as well. So there's just something about like the guide just takes on an extra load from the client, you know, makes it manageable, and the presence is there to support them in that process, you know? And so with that support, like again, those scary moments are often the most healing. And if you can stay with them and they can stay with the experience, you can make some of the scariest experiences the most transformative. That's the real power of the right set and setting.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about sort of the pre-education before even stepping into the event. And this is something that's kind of an interesting theme in the psychedelic world, where certainly some people have this idea of, I want to know as little as possible about the process. I want to know as little as possible about the medicine, and often what I hear from people is they say, well, I didn't want to be influenced by anything. I just wanted to meet the experience raw. And I've always been on the other side of that, like especially with 5-MeO-DMT, that I've always promoted the idea of, you really need to know, or at least educate yourself about what you're getting yourself into before doing this, because it is so monumental that you're going to be struggling to make sense of the experience. So I've really promoted the idea of education first. But even there, sometimes people come to me and say, yeah, I wanted to know as little as possible about it, but now I'm completely discombobulated, and that's why I'm reaching out to you for an integration session. And I said, well, you could have educated yourself first. But do you encounter that in your own work, where do you have people come in to say, oh, like, I don't want the education part. I just want to get right to the experience. And you know, how do you deal with that? Or maybe it's not an issue because you're working at a healing center, so there might be different expectations.
Yeah. You know, one of my first teachers was kind of on that old school side of things. Like he wouldn't even tell the medicine he was giving them. It was just some concoction, some sort of spiritual concoction, you know. And you know, I always felt a little weird about that. Like I'm coming, you know, with my psychotherapy training, you know, I think there's some ethical informed consent considerations to really pay attention to, you know. So you know, we do everything we can to provide as much full disclosure about the experience as possible. There are certain things I always share. And then I just sit and with my clients and answer every single question they have. And whether it takes, you know, one session or many sessions, I'll just sit and make sure that they feel 100% ready. So some people ask more questions than others, but I've just learned to provide some basic, there's just a few basic things I share with everyone before we begin, because I think it's an ethical informed consent piece. And in those moments, you know, like you're saying, you know, like that discombobulation, you know, like that could have been the most important moment. And if they had just a little more info, they would have been able to shift that into going deeper, you know, and fully surrendering and then finally full resolution. Whereas instead they might have gotten anxious and tried to break the experience instead. So we have a safety assessment, you know, that I've developed over some good amount of time, and you know, also based on other, you know, safety assessments for other psychedelic therapy centers and that I've found and such. And that is often, you know, like a springboard for people asking questions around safety and preparation and why did you ask this question and all of that, you know. So I'm usually just following the thread of what people need, you know, to hear. We have, like, because we're above board, we have disclosure statements, you know, that fully outline the expectations and services. And, you know, it's like we're legally obligated to provide that information, you know. So I'm more on your side too, Martin, you know, of like wanting to share and provide that. Because, you know, all in all, like there's a real debate around informed consent with psychedelics. Is like, how do you even prepare somebody for this? Like, you could tell them every single thing that could happen to them, and they still not going to be ready for the actual experience itself, you know? But at least they'll have context, like at least some context for it.
Yeah. You know? And that's really one of the advantages of being able to operate above ground, as you are doing in Colorado, where cannabis is legal. People can go to the store, you can buy it. Here in Oregon, it's the same way. You know, a lot of the Western states, we're now kind of on the same page when it comes to cannabis and accessibility. But of course, a lot of spiritual centers and a lot of people who provide medicine experiences, you know, it's still in a place where it's illegal. And so people have to be underground. And so then it becomes more secretive. And mm-hmm. then there is less disclosure. There's less conversation. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's such an important element that the more it can all be above ground, the more we can all be public about it, then the greater accessibility we have to genuine education and also mm-hmm. accountability in the development.
And accountability. Yeah. Yeah.
Development mm-hmm. of best practices. But if everybody's mm-hmm. operating in secret, how can you even have a conversation about what best practices mm-hmm. are?
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's just I don't remember where I read this, but like, a good analogy would be in alchemy. You know, there are all these alchemists keeping secrets and trying to discover the philosopher's stone by themselves.
Yeah.
And so there was no sharing of knowledge or sharing of the mistakes that were being made. So a lot of alchemists would just straight up die of the same thing over and over again because they accidentally poisoned themselves with mercury or whatnot. And if there was a little more informed, you know, information and sharing of information, a lot of harm could have been limited, right? And so I'm a huge fan of doing the work above board, and it's been quite the ride. It's like changing one set of problems for another, you know. But I like having paper between me and my clients so that it's mm-hmm. just something that we can share together and have a, you know, be very clear about expectations and the container that we're creating together and safety protocols and all of the above. Whereas with an underground practice, that would just be considered evidence of illegal activity. So
exactly.
So they just can't, you know, they can't provide those disclosure statements like I can, you know. And then the accountability piece, I think, is becoming more and more of a question in the psychedelic community. And I think that's an important one as well, you know. So being out, you know, like we've set up some, you know, mechanisms around accountability and making sure that we're held to good standards and my students and my team, you know, can agree to certain ethical standards and that we check each other, you know, we pay attention to that. And that's not as common in the underground communities just because of fear of persecution and whatnot as well. So I think we have a lot, like you said, you know, like it wasn't perfect 20 years ago. It's not perfect now, but we're growing, you know, like our community is learning a lot and growing. And I think we're got some growing pains to go through as a community, but I think we're on the right track. You know, I think as we becomes more legal, I think we're on the right track.
Yeah. So let's get into the idea specifically of psychedelic cannabis, and maybe let's sort of unpack that a little bit more. Because you do write about it in the book, and again, just to remind the listeners, we were discussing your book, Psychedelic Cannabis, Therapeutic Methods and Unique Blends to Treat Trauma and Transform Consciousness. And you do talk about how sometimes it can be very visual. It can be similar to, say, like a DMT mm-hmm. trip. And I find that very fascinating. I myself mm-hmm. have often not found cannabis to be all that visual at that level for me.
Sure.
With the exception of when I first moved to Ashland, Oregon back in 2007, that I started working trimming medical cannabis. And so I would do that for hours and hours and hours a day. And then I'd come home and I'd get high. And at night, when I'd go to sleep, I would see fractal permutations of cannabis leaves and buds, and it'd go on endlessly. And I talked to other people who worked in the trimming business, and most of them reported the same thing. And of course, most of the people who were trimming, that they were also consumers of cannabis. And so we'd get together the next day, and I was like, yeah, last night everything was green and leafy and all fractaled out for hours. And everybody else around the table was like, yeah, me too. And so it was like a really common phenomenon that it would kind of reach into these more visionary kinds of states. But you talk about like different blends and mixing different elements. So let's talk about that and sort of the alchemical art of really establishing a psychedelic cannabis experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, your experience is indicating, and I've had experiences like that too. It indicates that there is something going on here that is psychedelic in nature, you know, and cannabis technically is categorized as an hallucinogen, you know, so it does, you know, it's like, but there's something about like the way, like the war on drugs or our culture or whatever, it just never really it's just never been promoted as that, right? So those qualities have been dismissed in some ways. The other time cannabis is psychedelic accidentally is when people take too much of an edible, right? Mm-hmm. So they have a full-blown trip, but it is not fun, right? They might be having panic attacks. I've had, you know, like most cannabis consumers have had these experiences of eating too much of a brownie or something. And it's just not fun, right? So people say, yeah, that was kind of trippy, but why in the world would I do that again, right? Like, I'm going to avoid that, right? So most people generally avoid psychedelic trips with cannabis. So I think it's an issue of quality of the cannabis is just like, even in the last 5 years, it just keeps, the quality just keeps getting exponentially better, right? And so, and that allows for the terpene profiles, you know, the things that make it smell different ways, to just be even greater and greater and greater. Well, it turns out those terpenes, the essential oils, also have psychoactive effects too, you know? So when we blend the medicines together, when you blend a good sativa with a good indica, you know, strain together, you get to keep all the good traits of the indica and sativa, and the negative traits seem to disappear for some reason. So the sativa keeps you uplifted and awake and creative, but the indica takes the anxiety away from it. And then on the indica side, you get deep body relaxation and deep tissue healing process, but you don't have that dullness of a indica. You know, you don't feel droopy or sleepy. Mm-hmm. So there's some sort of holistic gestalt that's occurring where when you combine these different strains, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. It's like we used, like I was in the very beginning, I was trying to figure out words to call this experience. And I was thinking trans cannabis, you know, it's like it is cannabis, it's just pot, but there's something transcendent about this, something greater than just a strain of cannabis. So, and then the hybrid strains, which, you know, are very heart opening, you know. So imagine a blend of a sativa, indica, and hybrid. It keeps you elevated, awake, sharp, consciously focused, creative. The hybrids open your heart. It creates an MDMA-like effect where you just have a lot of emotional support. And then the indicas provide a deep, deep muscle relaxation, which allows the body to surrender enough to heal. And then there's other cannabinoids we add. We talked about CBN in the beginning. Mm-hmm. CBN is a deep muscle relaxant, but it also has a visual component as well. You know, so you can add that to a blend and it'll amplify the visual component of the experience. And so what you're left with, and again, man, like I'm as surprised as you are. And it took me years to trust that this was a thing that I could rely on because of my own beliefs about cannabis. But I just kept seeing it over and over again. One of the very first trips we did, my friend who's a cannabis lawyer, she said, if I didn't trust you, Daniel, I would swear you put DMT in that, you know, like she was having a full blown DMT experience, you know, full fractals, not subtle visuals, not muddied images or colors, but like bright colors flying through the cosmos or another reality. And we were just all blown away, you know, and blown away again and again and again. And so something about cannabis, it's its own unique plant medicine. You know, there's traits about it that feel very just cannabis, but it's also a shapeshifter. You know, it sometimes feels just like psilocybin, and you'll have visuals that are similar to psilocybin. Sometimes it feels just like MDMA, and it won't be visual, but it'll be very deeply relaxing and just feel really good and heart-centered and access to memories for trauma resolution work. Sometimes people say it was just like ayahuasca. You know, they describe it as just like ayahuasca. I've had experiences that were just like peyote. I've had experiences that were just like 5-MeO. I've sat for people with cannabis who will have like 5-MeO journeys in a row, like, but on cannabis. You know, it's just like something about it just keep bopping into that non-dual space in a really big way, you know? So I don't understand how it works, but cannabis is just by its nature psychedelic. And when you get the right blends, it's kind of like ayahuasca, like combining the DMT with the MAOI. You get the right combination of terpenes and cannabinoids together, it can be just as psychedelic as taking a hit of acid, you know? And that's the piece that's still surprises me and still, you know, like people like are starting to get that it's something that's as reliable as eating some shrooms or whatever, but we're still, you know, bringing it into the culture that, hey, this is a legal psychedelic. What can we do with it here? You know, like maybe there's an opportunity we should explore here, you know?
I'm curious if you have found, or if you feel that this would be a true statement or not. So for me, what I've noticed is that often cannabis, after having experienced another psychedelic, then can bring out echoes of that.
Yeah, like 100%.
It's like, oh, well, last week I had ayahuasca, and now I'm smoking some cannabis. I'm like, here we are back in ayahuasca again. But I'm curious, yeah, with clients who are coming to your center and doing this work, if many of them have prior psychedelic experience, so maybe they're more prone to have that sort of that returning echo, or are there people who are just experiencing cannabis for the first time and then also proclaiming, wow, that was super visual, and that was, you know, very bright and fractals, and then I went into non-duality, you know. Do you find that there's that correlation of prior experience of it then deepening for people, or is even with it for, say,
like naive,
someone who is kind of new to the whole space, if they're getting similar effects?
Yeah, I thought maybe that was a factor too, you know, especially in the beginning. And what happens, you know, so these are all just keys, right? So if you had just taken ayahuasca, the cannabis will open that door again so that you can go back into that neural patterning that was activated by the ayahuasca. And what happens, cannabis is a good integration tool, you know, so instead of doing another ayahuasca journey, which might just be too much, you know, you don't need to be too soon, you're not quite ready, or just physically fatigued from the last one, you can smoke a little cannabis, lie down, and complete whatever the ayahuasca journey was working you. You know, so it's a good resolution tool. So what I found, though, is that there's no correlation. People who've never taken a psychedelic or even ever smoked pot, they can have full-blown psychedelic experiences as well. And most of, you know, so people who are curious, you know, like psychedelic curious folks, never taken psychedelic, you know, they might come see me because, like, the idea of ayahuasca sounds too scary, so they'll start with cannabis. But then they have a full-blown 3-hour ayahuasca journey working with me. The primary difference between, say, ayahuasca and cannabis is that there's just a lot more agency with cannabis. You can kind of hit the pause button with cannabis. Like, say you wanted to sit up and go to the restroom, you can just sit up, you know, kind of reorient, and then you're kind of just high. You're not tripping anymore. With ayahuasca, like, there's, that's not really an option.
Yeah, you're swimming through cosmic space just to get to the bathroom.
Just to get to the bathroom, right? With cannabis, you just go right back to being high. But then as soon as you lay back down again, it's like you hit the play button and it comes right back on. It's pretty wild that way. So that's a big difference. One correlation I have found is that people who've done a lot of psychotherapy or have had a lot of mindfulness practice, experience in mindfulness practice, can really go deep with these skill sets, you know, and these experiences. So it's like they just have a skill set, a navigational skill set, and are able to engage the material more than, say, somebody who's never had practices like that. So with trauma, you know, it's usually pretty spontaneous. You know, somebody's coming for deep trauma healing, it'll usually, like, no matter what their experience, that stuff's going to come up for it to be resolved. And that's like Stan Grof's inner radar idea of just, it, you know, your body knows exactly what to do if given the opportunity to heal, you know?
Yeah. And just something I wanted to kind of reiterate about what you said, that you can use cannabis to kind of resolve processes that it started on another psychedelic, but maybe hasn't reached a point of resolution or a point of completion. And it's surprising to some people. It's actually exactly what I recommend for people who perhaps have had trouble fully processing a 5-MeO experience, that they think, oh, well, like, that's completely on the opposite end of the spectrum of cannabis. And it's actually advice that I give people quite often. The idea is, well, you're incomplete from your 5-MeO experience, so take some cannabis, and then, just as you're saying, lie down, go into your body, pay attention to what's going on in your body, and it can help bring it to a point of resolution. And it might even go all the way into a full 5-MeO experience.
It might,
Then you can actually come out of that feeling more complete and more grounded. And I think that's just one of these really powerful aspects of cannabis, that not only can you take it while you're working with any other psychedelic and it can augment it, but it does have this really powerful ability of post experience helping you to integrate and bring to resolution what might have been a bumpy ride or something that just hasn't reached a point of completion. And I think it's such an important concept that a lot of people leave their psychedelic event incomplete. And that's what causes anxiety and being disturbed afterwards. And here we have this wonderful tool. I mean, it's so great that you're in Colorado, I'm in Oregon, we have easy access to this. It's like, great. You can go and go to your dispensary, you can get the medicine that you need, you can go back into your experience in a much more manageable way. But really, I think, as you're emphasizing here, and I like to emphasize as well, that the focus is not on going out, but really going into your body, paying attention to how you are embodying the experience, and that's where the resolution actually happens.
Everything happens in the body, right? Like, that's, you know, in some ways that's who we are. We got a brain, which is part of our body as well, right? And so I tell people, it's like, man, sometimes that, you know, you see it in people's faces when they've gone through a big journey. It's just not fully complete. It's like 90% there, you know? And the idea of going through a major ego dissolution process again is just going to be too much and might even destabilize them even more. But then what do? Like you said, like, that unresolved process causes anxiety and other symptoms. And cannabis, man, it can go in there. It can just smooth everything out, clear that chunk of dross that didn't quite get dislodged. And then you're great. You just feel better, you know, because there's this completion and resolution. We call these, we have 2-day cannabis retreats that we work with. We call them chapter turning experiences. You know, it's not that, you know, it's like all your issues in life are resolved, but, you know, you can turn the chapter on something, you know, and finally get, you know, that topic's complete, you know, like, it's time to explore the next stage of life or whatever. So, yeah, I'm glad you're offering that. Not everybody gets that. So I'm glad to hear that you're offering cannabis for that work. It's important.
Yeah. So I really want to get into talking about the center and the programs that you run there. But I do have a question that I didn't really see come up in your book at all. And I'm just curious if you have just any thoughts on this. And that's around the fact that we have built into the human body is the endocannabinoid system, that our bodies are actually primed for cannabinoids, that it's part of our functional nervous system. And for me, I've always thought that that's part of why cannabis works so well, is because it's actually very natural to our bodies. So I'm just wondering if, you know, if you have any thoughts that you wanted to share on that. Again, because I didn't see anything about that in the book, not that it needed to be there, but I was just sort of curious if you had any thoughts around that subject that you'd want to share.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think I didn't include certain topics because, you know, people have already written about that, and I wanted to, you know, address like the potential use of cannabis as a psychedelic. Cannabis affects the 5-HT2A receptor, like the serotonin receptors, like other psychedelics do. So there is something there with that. But you're absolutely right, is that every cell in our being has these cannabinoid receptors, and it's to bring our bodies, our psyches, our minds to help us return to homeostasis. There's something, it's a regulatory mechanism in the body, you know? And so if you're too elevated or something's too activated, cannabis, THC and CBD, other cannabinoids will help drop us down. If it's too low, we're hypo-aroused, depressed, it'll bring us up. Right. So like the mechanism is returning to homeostasis. And when you add a good dose of cannabis, what happens is it starts to activate the nervous system before it splits into the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Right. So it's called a charged equilibrium, meaning you're fully activated and awake, but also fully deeply relaxed and accepting at the same time. It's a charged homeostasis. And that's all done through the endocannabinoid system. And then the other aspect, which I think is really incredibly relevant when it comes to trauma resolution therapies with cannabis, is inflammation. You know, there's we get cellular inflammation from trauma, you know, either from disease or injury or illness, but also from, you know, emotional traumas as well. It causes significant inflammation in the body. And there are these cannabinoid receptors in every cell of our being that when you drop a molecule of CBD into it, it relaxes the inflammation in the body. And so that's why cannabis is used for pain and arthritis and such. But it's not a numbing. It's not a numbing experience. You might be even more aware of your arthritis or pain. It's just not as inflamed. And so it's actually physically healing. So I think we're about 2% of what we know, what we could know about cannabis. I think there's that much potential with this medicine. And I think we're going to start seeing really advanced applications for both physical healing, but also, you know, applications in altering very specific states of mind using THC as a booster rocket in combination with other molecules, other essential oils, and, you know, other supplements and things. And it'll be kind of like a designer mind state practice that we'll be able to do for different applications, creative problem solving, like trauma resolution, healing, artistic expression, emotional connection, interconnection with communities, possible resolution of conflict in communities. You know, there's going to be so many applications, and it's all about bringing everybody down to a regulated homeostasis so they can think clearly.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. So when did you make the transition from kind of experimenting with friends and associates and kind of doing this work to then actually putting together a center that could house all of this, as from the actual sessions themselves to education and training programs? What was that process like for you?
I started my program before cannabis became legal in 2012. It was a harm reduction program, and I wanted to teach people how to sit for their friends and things. So we started doing workshops of like just psychedelic education and harm reduction and skill sets of how to create a safe space for you and your friends. And so the education piece was always part of it. And then cannabis became legal here in 2014. And so I started groups. We called them conscious cannabis circles. And they were, so imagine a group of, you know, a dozen, sometimes we'd have as many as 30 people lying in a circle after they've smoked some cannabis, and I'd play a music set for them, and people would have righteous psychedelic experiences, you know. So it was just fun. We would, you know, it's more on the spiritual creative side, you know, is when I, you know, in those containers. And then I started realizing people were coming because it was helping them heal and resolving their, you know, whatever traumas they were working through. And I was also seeing people shaking on their mats, you know. And I started to see that there was a correlation there to like somatic trauma therapies and such. And so I started to, and people just started to ask me, do you do this on an individual basis? And so I started to invite, you know, like I would go to people's homes and set up my speaker system, and they would do a journey on their living room floor or something. And that was, you know, not too long after the conscious cannabis circles, maybe a couple of years, I started to really develop that. Laws made it prohibitive. We couldn't work outside of homes for many years. So I worked out of my own home. I had a really nice meditation studio in my basement, you know, so it would be dark and very private. And so it was mostly me in my private practice. My wife would sometimes facilitate journeys with her clients as well. But then social use laws in Colorado became more prevalent. You know, they're still kind of on the beginning side of that. And so I was able to negotiate with a owner of a commercial property here to allow us to do these practices in sessions, you know, like at the commercial space. And so now we're officially a center. I have 8 practitioners working with us. Most are psychotherapists, but we have a couple of interfaith ministers, psychotherapists in training. We also provide ketamine services as well. So we have a medical doctor on staff. And we just added a group space here. So, so we'll be able to facilitate groups as much as 12, 16 folks at a time. And that's going to make our services much more accessible, much more affordable to be able to offer them again in groups. With COVID, all our group work shut down for, 18 months or so. So we're just now starting to get back into providing groups experiences as well.
Yeah. And actually, since you mentioned that, I'm curious, are you getting people in now? Certainly, I've been reading a lot around mental health around COVID and just the idea that not even people who have had COVID, which itself just sounds like a really horrendous, horrible experience, but that the population in general has actually been traumatized by this. And I'm curious if you're seeing elements of that kind of coming up in this work, that we've all been cut off, we've been filled with anxiety, all this uncertainty, this political crazy turmoil that we've been in. Is that showing up in sessions? And
it's in the sessions, yes. I mean, everybody's had a difficult couple of years, to say the least. And we've been affected. My grandmother died of COVID.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. A lot of people have experienced great loss during this period. But just the uncertainty and the isolation, people with, mental health struggles, all of that got amplified. And so we're at the beginning of a major mental health crisis in this country, I think. And it's starting, and it shows up sometimes. Trauma shows up as aggression sometimes, right? Yeah. And so we've had to, guard the edges of our program of people who really need help but don't have the right personal wherewithal to ask for it in the right way, And so, and in some ways, being a psychedelic practitioner, we become targets of weird behavior, around us, So I'd say it hasn't really shown up in our sessions. Our clients are just amazing human beings, but we've sometimes had to protect the edges of our program in ways that we hadn't before, hadn't had to in the past, people really seeking help, but might be on the delusional side and the psychotic side, because it's just something in them broke during this period. So I think we're on the beginning of a major emotional roller coaster in this country, and it seems to be getting worse at this point, not better, So we're hoping to be able to, help as many people as we can and work with as many people as we can and teach as many people as we can, because cannabis is easier and more accessible than other psychedelics. So it's translatable more so in that way. But a lot of people really need our help. And we're seeing this across the board. I talked to other practitioners and other communities and stuff, and everybody's just a little more amped up than they were before. And some of it has gotten a little on the scary side,
I can definitely appreciate that. Seems to be a major motivating factor for the book itself is to really help people, and even the do-it-yourself approach, giving people the tools that, yes, you can come to the center and you can get this education, you can get these experiences, but also, functioning as a guidebook for how people can learn how to do this themselves, and really detailed instructions about the body scans, about the breath work, about the time frames of when to focus on this. And that actually brings me to, I'd invite you to speak about any of that you want, but something that came up that you mentioned previously that I want to come back to is what music works best for these different practices. But
that's a fun part of it.
So any part of that, but definitely I want to talk about music, because I love talking about music and how it works so well in conjunction with psychedelic medicines, and was such an integral part of the experience. But you're welcome
to pick
up on that riff anywhere you want.
Maybe just say I wrote the book after a friend of mine and I attended a special conference on psychedelics and spirituality. My friend Travis Cox, he was on the board of Naropa University. He's an established eco-psychology professor and such. And, you know, we were in LA and the UN just came out with a report that within 10 years, we're past the breaking point in our ecology. And to be honest, you know, that scared me a little bit. And I realized I had this tool that it can help heal trauma so people can be more resilient in this world. And it's also a good problem solver. You know, cannabis as a good problem solver is really great. You know, like world problems to personal life problems. It just gives you good ideas to that. And I felt like ethically obligated to share this given the crisis point we're in the world, you know, like waiting for like the FDA, getting all this approved with the FDA would be a 20-year process, you know, and hoarding it myself just so I can market my own program or make money off it didn't feel right either, given that like that'd be like profiting off a crisis. And I didn't like that idea. So I got back from this conference and I just wrote it all down. I was like, here's exactly how to do it. Here, you know, here's what you need. Here's the setting that you need. Here's the time frame of these experiences. Here's how to make the blend so you can have the experiences. And here are specific skill sets that you can use to resolve trauma so that we can survive this period of time, you know? And so that was a really meaningful and intentional process for me. And it, you know, and it was real intense. It was a real intense creative process and loved it, you know, loved every bit of it. I first self-published, you know, just to get the info out there. And, and that's when I got picked up by Inner Traditions to get for the second edition to get published. And they even made an audiobook, so you don't even have to read it anymore to get the information. So I was super stoked to see that. We talk a little bit about like music selections and stuff in the book. You know, again, these are really big questions, but what music is the best is it's like so personal, right? And so when I do one-on-one sessions, I'll actually live mix the music and pick music as I go and match what I think the person's where they're at and kind of nudge them in different directions with the music. You'd think that somebody struggling with a lot of trauma would want relaxing music. But some of the people who, you know, benefit the most are, you know, I play real evocative music for them as they're going through big experiences. And that seems to be the best thing for them. And, you know, I play a lot of soundtracks, you know, from movies, you know, things that have like a story associated with them. I play a lot of ambient, a lot of tribal music, I love cello, you know, and it's very, you know, evocative, emotionally evocative music. And so I just try to keep it, broad, you know, so if like not all classical, I think, you know, like all classical music for the psilocybin experiences, I think that's pretty outdated at this point, you know. It's so it's a lot of world music that we play, anything with no vocals, you know, or at least legible vocals, you know, we try to stay away from things that you can understand. And it's a big part of the experience. Music activates new neural pathways in the brain, and I think that forms another dimensional aspect of the work. And then there's like a synesthesia between, you know, like hallucinatory visual experiences and the music itself, you know, and so it creates this inner landscape that people can kind of play in and explore. And that's a lot of fun, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just to kind of, comment and reiterate a few things that you mentioned there that I also have found is very important is, that the music not all be the same, and especially that it not all just be relaxing and welcoming music, that it actually is important to introduce some sonic elements that might be edgy or a bit more challenging, and that actually gives people an opportunity to have that synesthetic experience with the music, to kind of enter into their own edges and their own discomfort, and actually helps it process through. And that by having a playlist that goes through all these different emotional and textual elements is actually what's more productive than just, you know, like some people just like to put on meditation music. And for me, I feel that there's room for that, But I would never want the whole playlist to just be a meditation track, that it needs to have these other elements. And also the idea of music without lyrics. And I also like to avoid music that calls up any specific religious or spiritual tradition, because people might have either an attachment to it or some kind of aversion that it triggers within them. So that's where I also like more world music that's not like, oh yeah, this is a Christian hymn or that's a Sanskrit chant or something, but giving people more space to kind of have their own interpretation and create their own imagery around it. And again, introducing some elements that might be a little uncomfortable musically, but that can help trigger some of these releases and help the process through that. And it's a fine art. And I love that you're actually doing like live psychedelic DJing for your sessions. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, cannabis, you know, can be a shorter experience, like 3 hours versus eight, you know, so it's a little easier to live mix a set when you don't have to fill 8 hours of music. Yeah. I have songs that I call the Vikings are coming, you know, like I create all kinds of wild experiences with the music and sometimes try to evoke, an activation in the nervous system because somebody's really stuck, you know, they just need to feel again, you know, because, you know, they know they're safe and I know they're ready for what, you know, just through our discussions or whatever, that they're ready to explore those edges. And so, and then the heart opening and the sad music, you know, somebody needs to grieve, playing some songs that are sad, you know, just get people to, finally surrender into letting themselves feel deep grief, you know, like music is just such an essential part of the program, you know, and part of these experiences. I've always been a lover of music. There's so much good electronic music out, you know, that doesn't have the, you know, those connotations to different cultures and religions and things that are great for this. Anything rhythmic, you know, anything will train the brain and do all kinds of stuff when you get a rhythm in there too. So there's lots of good reasons to use music.
Yeah, it's just such a great tool. Oh, there was something I was going to say and it just flew out the window. Maybe I'll remember in a minute, but it was something about music. Sorry, I completely lost my train of thought because I was into what you were saying. Gosh, I wish I could remember. It was something interesting. No, I'm completely off track. Well, where do you see all of this moving forward? Let's go there. And if my thought reoccurs to me, then I'll bring it back. Yeah.
Where all of this, you know, we're talking about pretty big subjects here, psychedelics or cannabis.
Well, specifically the work around cannabis and healing. Yeah.
I think that people are going to get it more, you know, like as we get more experience and share it more. I think cannabis is going to become more and more understood as a psychedelic. That's my hope anyway. You know, we're working to teach people how to do this, you know, and so we've got little centers and communities all over the country and Canada, you know, so I hope psychedelics just in general are integrated into society in a way that's sustainable and healthy, and deeply inspiring. I'd say like long-term I'm paying attention to the corporate interests that are coming into the movement, and, you know, really making sure that we have the voice of, you know, the tradition of transpersonal psychology is still relevant through this process. So I think there's going to be some big debates in the future around like the trajectory of psychedelics in our culture. We don't want to make them so mainstream they lose their magic, you know, but we want them to be accessible and we gotta make them legal, you know, like there's no excuse for things like this to be illegal. So I'm just going to keep doing my part to be an advocate for these medicines and to be, you know, to show an example of how it could be done in a good way. And that hopefully that inspires people to keep that path going and alive, you know, but I think psychedelics are here. I don't think they're going to be able to block them again like they are, but I'd like to really advocate for safe use practices so that we can stay safe but really live into our potential with these medicines, you know. So I think the world and then the world itself is in such a turbulent area, you know, such a turbulent period. Is this a stage? Are we, you know, a transition stage? Are we going to get through this, or is this what it looks like now, you know? And so using psychedelics to help navigate, you know, like as a survival mechanism to navigate these spaces, again, to gain like ideas and resolution to problems so that we can have a good lives through this period, I think is really important. Trauma resolution is probably the most important thing we can do for the world right now, because there's just so much trauma, you know, from war and uncertainty and ecological destruction, and race and class issues, you know. So there's so much potential. Question is, are we going to be able to act, you know, to live into that? I don't know the answer, but I think you, me, a lot of people are really trying. So I'm hopeful more than distraught.
Yeah, good. So I'm just curious, what's your perception of sort of the state of affairs in Colorado itself? Because again, sort of like Oregon, it's been very progressive in Colorado. I know that there have been some decriminalization acts that have taken place there as well. But just what's your feel of sort of the psychedelic access and culture within Colorado itself?
Yeah, you know, Colorado is this weird place where like Western individualism and freedom kind of mix with more progressive values than not. You know, I'd say we're more of a purple state than anything. I think Colorado did a really good job in regulating cannabis, you know, from a solid business perspective, but also with awareness of social issues. And I think that's showing up in the movement for the decriminalization of psilocybin. There's some really great activists in Denver who brought decrim to through Spore, an organization called Spore, and decriminalized psilocybin there. And they're working to make it a state initiative. You know, so I think Colorado has the potential to be one of these places where these medicines become legal before other places.
Yeah.
And I'm hopeful for that, you know. But you know, Boulder, you know, it's a progressive town. You know, it's got its issues and things, but it's one of the few places that I could have done this work 10 years ago. And that's one of the reasons I landed here, was like I felt safe enough to engage these practices. You know, the fact that I have an office, like that's not going to happen a lot of places, you know. But since the 10 years, I mean, there's now lots of places that I could do this work in. And so I see the progression. And I think what we're going to see is legalization of cannabis on the federal level, maybe in the next 4 or 5 years. Like people think it's right around the corner, but I don't really trust that. And it's okay. Like I don't have to deal with that right now. And then moving quickly behind that is going to be the legalization of psilocybins. Or psilocybin MDMA through FDA approval process, but I think the state initiatives, the ballot initiatives, you know, the legalization initiatives that sidestep the FDA, I think they're probably going to surpass that. And so there's going to be a huge debate within our community of right context. You know, the people who want to do it clinical and medical and have the FDA approval are going to want to monopolize it. And then other people are going to really push back on that and say, hey, we've been using these medicines for, you know, what, 10,000 years. Maybe we don't have to require a doctor to prescribe it, you know. So there's going to be a huge debate. And it's going to be fascinating to watch and to be part of.
Yeah. I think that's a really important one, and one that I've liked to write about and speak about, that I think that it's great to have the clinical approach, and I think it's great to have the clinics and the trained professionals, but that there also needs to be room for, you know, secular use, spiritual use, religious use, traditional use, and kind of have all of these elements work together. And not everyone needs to be trained the same way. Not everybody needs to follow the same protocols, but yeah, I think it's very fortunate that you were able to do all of this in Colorado. You know, just to share one quick experience for myself, that, you know, like I mentioned, that I got into cannabis when I was in high school, and I very quickly became an advocate for, like, we need to change the laws around this. You know, I was like posting flyers up in my high school about why cannabis should be legalized.
That's awesome.
And then You know, after moving to Oregon, and when medical cannabis was already legal, but there weren't any retail shops yet. But then the laws changed and allowed for retail shops, only for medical initially, and now it's both medical and recreational. But I remember the day that a friend of mine opened the very first dispensary in our local area for medical cannabis, and I drove up in my car. And this is completely unexpected, but I just broke down crying in the car in the parking lot. It's just like, I can't believe this day is here. And, you know, it's coming in more areas. And I think that it's great that cannabis was the first domino to fall here because it has so many applications and it is so easy to use and it is so safe in so many ways. And that it's just the beginning of this transformation. And I fully agree with you that the socio-political, economic, racial, and particularly environmental situation that we're all currently facing necessitates new approaches and necessitates change. And it is traumatic to think about. You know, we live in the West. You get wildfires just like we're getting wildfires, and the smoke and all of this from climate change, that it's really having an impact now, and that we haven't even reached the point that scientists say this is what we really need to be concerned about, you know. So I think it's only going to become more traumatic, and we're going to need more healing modalities and more ways to address this in a way that really brings the most benefit to the most amount of people. And to that end, I think that your book really serves, can really serve humanity in that way, because we do have more access to cannabis than we do to these other medicines.
Right.
I'm curious.
Appreciate that, man.
Yeah. Do you feel there's going to be another book down the road, or is this what you have?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You know, so using this as a therapeutic tool for psychotherapists and guides, you know, it's like this first book was about, you know, peer work and doing your own work, but there's a lot of skill sets that we can teach and some orientations that we can share. So that's in the works. You know, there's some, we haven't talked really about this, but I have a DMTX project, and there's a lot of interest in that program. And so there could be books around that as well. You know, I'm so busy doing the work, it's hard to find time to write, you know, so I'm trying to restructure my life so I can get back into writing and get more information out there. But as soon as I can, I'll share everything I can, because I agree with you. I think it's that inspiring and that important, you know. So.
Yeah. Well, I certainly got the impression from your book that you're a busy guy, because you're running a lot of different programs. And I'll even say that, you know, your book ended up in my mailbox completely unexpectedly. That I figured out later how it got to me, but it was just like the book came addressed to my podcast. I was like, whoa, well, where did this come from? And I'm really glad that it did. And
yeah, me too.
I'm really grateful that you were able to make time for me today to have this conversation. I know you've got training programs coming up, so I'm sure your mind is pointed in that direction. But it's been great getting to know you and speak with you today, Daniel. And as I mentioned in the emails, you're the third Daniel in a row here in the podcast. So
yeah, we the Daniel into cluster together. It's funny. That's great.
Yeah. So I just like the way that worked out, but, let's wrap it up with anything that you feel that we didn't touch on, and also where can people find you online? And again, your book is Psychedelic Cannabis, Therapeutic Methods and Unique Blends to Treat Trauma and Transform Consciousness. Is this out now? That you mentioned that it had been self-published, I think, under a slightly different title previously. But
just came out yesterday, so it's on Amazon. Perfect. And you can get an audiobook of it, and through Inner Traditions. I'm assuming they're going to be putting it in stores too. So Inner Traditions has been really great to work with. Just want to give a big shout out to them. I learned so much working with that group, and so I think that's how you got that copy.
Yeah.
So super grateful for them. I learned a lot working with them. Definitely get the book if that's all you ever do. Really wish you well with that. But we have a center here in Boulder, Colorado. It's called the Center for Medicinal Mindfulness, medicinalmindfulness.org. And then I have my training program called Psychedelic Sitter School, where I teach people how to use cannabis as a psychedelic to be a guide for others. And it's a great training program and a good foundational skill set to work with other medicines, you know, but we specifically work with cannabis, and because I'm just so inspired by it, you know, so, So yeah, come visit. And Martin, I'd love to introduce this work to you as well. So if you're ever in this area, I'll show you the space and introduce you to the plant in a new way. So,
great. Great.
Anytime.
Well, thanks so much for your time today, Daniel. Really appreciate it. And congratulations on the book being out today. This podcast, this will come out on Monday. So your book will have been out for a few days, but I'm really happy to have had this interview with you right as the book is launching.
Yeah.
And I hope that it serves you in that capacity as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It's really great being here. And I followed your work for a while. So it's been real special to connect with you in this way.
All right. Right on, Daniel.